Hello and welcome the internet to advice
to the players.
To the players. I'm your host, Jonathan Redding. With me as always is Monsieur
Philip Kelly.
With us looking dapper.
And with my thank you. It's the beard.
Yeah, he's got a little gray in his beard. He's got a little steel in the beard.
It was red and now it's gray.
It's husky. That's for our lady listeners.
Yeah, right?
Yeah. So ladies, I know this is an audio medium, but just take my word for it.
We'll post a photo later.
He looks good.
Thank you.
I like it.
And I'm here with my sinus infection headache today, too, which is awesome.
We can't get well between the two of us.
No.
We're just passing flus and viruses back and forth.
Sorry, guys. You're going to have a great closing night tonight.
Yeah. Hit yourselves up with some Airborne. And we have with us today on the show, we're very excited to have from the Porters of Hell's Gate, Mr. Alex Parker.
Hello.
Welcome. Thank you for coming on the show. And we also have Gus Krieger.
Morning.
Both of these gentlemen, longtime members of the Porters, and I've been seeing both of you guys perform for a couple of years now, and I'm excited to have you on the show and have you, you know, just have an opportunity to pick your brains.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Mr. Leon Russom.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for coming out, sir. It's great to see you in King Lear. You play Gloucester in King Lear.
I do.
That is accurate.
Did you read the program before we...
I did. I sat down with it. I skipped the show. I napped. I power napped.
Power nap?
For 3 hours.
That's a long power nap.
Let me say, I saw King Lear when I was in high school in Minneapolis at the Guthrie Theater, and I fell asleep. Because it was so awful.
God.
But I stayed awake during your guys' King Lear.
Thank you.
Who was the Lear?
I don't even remember. I have no recollection of what happened after the first 10 minutes and what happened.
Because that place
Great
always sounds like...
Minutes, yeah. What's
that?
That
place always sounds golden.
Oh, it's a wonderful theater.
The Guthrie.
The Guthrie's. Yeah. Great theater.
I actually, I saw my first stage production of Lear that I saw was when I was abroad college in England, and it was Corin Redgrave at the RSC, and I think it's... maybe long enough after now to tell the truth. The production was terrible. Really bad. Admittedly, it was not helped by the fact that we were all sitting in literally the last possible row of the theater in the balcony, you know, so we're like a mile and a half from the stage, but half the class had fallen asleep by the end of Act 1, and then they do like a super loud thunder boom because of the storm, and everybody sits up suddenly, and it reminded me of The Simpsons where they have to press the button for the bird screech to make everybody wake up, because that's exactly what it was like for my class. That's
I awesome. Never saw Lear until I was about 22, I guess. And then I saw what I still think is the greatest Lear ever, which was Paul Scofield in Peter Brook's version.
Oh, nice.
And, so ever since then, it's very hard to appraise other Lears, because it's like, oh, it's not Scofield.
Yeah, you were there for the gold standard.
From my point of view.
Yeah.
I mean, on the other hand, I've never seen some of the plays done well at all.
That's what true. Is, who's Darth Vader? I'm so sorry.
James Earl Jones.
I saw James Earl Jones's Lear online a couple of weeks ago, just because I was actually looking for something like a funny King Lear video on YouTube to post on our Twitter account, and when I searched it, James Earl Jones's Lear in Shakespeare in the Park was one of the top things, and I was like, oh, interesting, let me check this out. He was good. The rest of them, almost across the board, they were awful. This was the 80s. Clearly acting styles have changed since then. If this was what you were supposed to be doing, and I was watching it though, and I was like, oh, man, I was skipping around. I probably watched a total of 10 minutes of it. I was like, I can't, no, next scene, I can't do this. It was so weird.
My most fun Lear anecdote is that was in a production of Much Ado, and the gentleman playing Antonio, the brother, or the Beatrice's father, he was very upset that some of his lines were cut. And at a preview performance, right? And it was just bloated. It was running long, but at a preview performance, he launched into this amalgam Lear monologue that he transplanted into the show. Like at the scene where he's like, you know, you boys, you curs, and he's, you know, swinging the belt around.
Amazing.
There's this beat, and he suddenly yells, "Blow winds and crack your cheeks!" And we're like leaning out from backstage with just terror on our faces. And he went for like 3-4 minutes, and people in the audience Like, even people that didn't know Lear well enough to recognize the line, and if you're going to quote Lear, that's the most recognizable part.
That's fucking incredible.
You know, are just... Everyone knew something was badly wrong.
Well, it's funny, because that line, when I saw the Schofield, I was a student, and I went to three previews, and then second acted it, I don't know how many times after that. But Schofield... I went to my teachers afterwards, and I went, you know, he does things that quite the opposite of what you guys are teaching us. Mm. And when he got to Blow Winds and Crack Your Cheeks, he literally just scanned it and just went, blow wind, and he slapped his thigh as he was doing it and went, blow winds and crack your cheeks. And I was watching and going, what the hell is he doing? And then I found out later that he had this thing that he called earning the right to speak, and until he knew what he was, how he was going to do a thing, he would just stick to the text and make the text do all the work. And of course, when I said that was not the way they were teaching us to work, went, well, yes, but you see, he's Paul Schofield. He can work any way he wants.
Isn't that interesting, the point when people, you know, get to in their careers where it's sort of like, yeah, you know what, I've earned the right to disregard everything and just sort of do it my own way. And that's, I don't know, something very unique about the profession. You don't get to do that if you're an architect or, you know, something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, you don't get to ignore the arch.
The building will fall.
Right. That's a staple.
I'm gonna build the top floor first.
I mean, it's a staple of writing in general, is like that one of the things that I remember learning really early on is like you have to learn the rules of grammar, and then once you do, you can break them all you want.
Yeah, break them to pieces.
And it's a terrible thing with text messaging and stuff today. You read text messages and you're like, you don't know what you're doing at all, do you? And it's like, you didn't earn the right at all to talk that way. How dare you?
My text messages are grammatically perfect. But there's something in my brain that's just dissonant when I type incorrectly.
I actually love to say things like for show, and like I use the word yo constantly because I like to believe that people that don't know me too well that are texting me, but they've seen me do things like fucking King Lear, and they're like, wait, this guy talks like a fucking asshole. What is he using the word yo for? All the time.
It's that horrible thing where you start to do it ironically and then it just becomes
it's what I was doing. I was like, I'm gonna be a joker to this guy. This guy's not gonna know what hit him, and then all of a sudden I talk this way now, and it's like, well, I didn't intend this, but fuck it, I don't give a shit.
But you know, in the text there are these weird things. Dana has a line, and then I have one relatively similar within a minute, where, and I don't see it anywhere else in the text, where she goes, yar.
Yeah, yar, yar, I note.
Virtually right out of Long John Silver. Yeah. And then when Gus is leading me, I have one which is, methinks yar better spoken.
Yeah.
And you go, oh God, just all of a sudden it's Robert Newton.
Can't we say you are? Doesn't that not scan? Yeah. Okay, I will pirate it up then. Yeah,
Shakespeare messing with our brains.
Yeah.
Just to create a frame for the discussion and the anecdotes, because I didn't when I was introducing you individually. You know, we have Leon playing Gloucester, and then the two of you, Alex and Gus, are the brothers Gloucester, or the Alex plays the bastard Edmund.
It's three earls.
Yeah, just a couple of earls.
Three earls or Gloucester.
Three earls on a log.
Except one of them's going to become king.
He can suck it.
Whoa, hey, come on.
And Gus playing Edgar and Tom of Bedlam, his other guys. So this was sort of the idea. I wanted to sit down and talk to you guys about, you know, about House Gloucester. And, of course, this is perfectly timed because we just found the OG, the original Gloucester.
Yeah. Yeah.
They found his body, finally.
Yeah, they did, in a parking lot.
In a parking lot.
He's... In the parking lot, you might talk about it. Have you seen it there on the third floor?
Have you seen the meme? Have you seen the meme like champion of hide and seek? have you seen that meme yet?
No. I haven't.
That's like, I can't remember.
My immediate thought was like, all right, there are going to be so many parking lot horse jokes.
Oh God, so many. Yeah. No, but my favorite.
Have you seen the skeleton?
Yeah.
God, that spine.
Oh yeah, it's awful. Grotesque.
I mean, to live with that. Yeah.
I feel like there are so many actors who played Richard who just feel vindicated because they started to assail the idea that he was deformed.
Right.
And it's like, no, well, he might have still not been a child murderer, but he was deformed.
He was deformed.
Either that or they just arranged the bones in a crippled fashion. Because I'm looking at him, it's like, couldn't you just put him straight?
The spine itself looks so enlarged compared to spines that I've seen. That you sort of,
yeah, I've seen Predator.
Take this
the spine's
from a whale?
And Gus is, you've played Richard, correct?
Yes, it was the third show that the Porters ever did, and I was blessed enough to play the part, the character actor's Hamlet, as they call it in Year of the King. And that was a hell of a thing. I don't know if there will ever be an experience sort of equal to it in my career, just in terms of tackling the iconography and something that is so in everybody's minds one way or another, and sort of the only way that I was able to stay sane doing it was just sort of to act as if it were a new play. I've been in new plays before, you know, first productions of things, and like, okay, well, you know what, it's the first time these lines have ever been said, and we'll just do that. I watched you know, like a dozen interpretations of it, like 3 months out, you know, when I still had a lot of time to distance myself, and sort of took all that in and held it all, and then, you know, got to the point of where I was able to sort of do my own thing. But you know, I was younger. I was still in my early to mid 20s at that point, so I got to, you know, rely on my exuberance a bit more than I maybe
you're
would if
long
I were to
be
do
tall.
It today. Yeah, yeah.
That's fine. I played him about the same age.
Oh, cool.
And I want to go back to feel like I didn't get all of it.
Yeah, always. Yeah, always feel that
always.
Way. But then, like, I don't know, part of me, like, I feel like I don't even have the energy at this point. And like,
drop
it's like,
the mic.
Yeah, it's like, I'd like to do it. Maybe I could do it, like, in a movie project version, because then you don't have to exert yourself as much on a daily basis.
But, well, you played Gloucester in R3 last year, didn't you?
Pardon?
No, who were you in R3?
No, you were Buckingham.
Buckingham. No, Buckingham.
I was Buckingham.
No,
I'm sorry.
I'm mixing words.
Yeah, and, we, and I should not have been. I mean,
you were fantastic. You were the saving
no
grace of
being
that
in
production.
That production. I had gone to Sacred Fools, another company in town, and I went there to do Endgame, which is my favorite non-Shakespearean play ever.
Ham, I assume.
Yeah, and I never expected to get to play it. I figured if I was ever going to do that play, I'd be clothed, because it's just the way I see myself. I'm not a very large person. And so I got the opportunity to do that. And they're mostly half my age, and they're brilliant comics, you know, and terribly creative mix at the Sacred Fools. But they wanted to do a classic. And so because I'd just done Endgame, it was like, well, Leon's got to be in it. And I kept telling them that Buckingham needs to be a contemporary to Richard for it to really make sense. And so I had to do lots of manipulating in my head to turn him into like Richard's Karl Rove, you know, and make him like the money in the Empire. And that he could... my image was like the industrialists in the 30s in Germany, who opted for Hitler. They looked at what was going on and went, that's a winner.
Yeah.
And so I took it from that point of view.
As a venture capitalist.
Yeah, who just saw which way things were going. And then, of course, makes the wrong choice and winds up dying. But I had no business doing it, except that it was fun to do.
that's how you met him too, right? That's how I met you. And... your appearance was so much different from when you first came on and we did the first table read of Lear, because you had the goatee, the full goatee, and you were very clean cut up here.
Mm-hmm.
And so whenever you came on, I was sitting outside the door of the theater when I was waiting for everybody to come in, just to greet everybody, tell them we're going to go upstairs to do this table read, and you come up, and I'm like, hi, my name's Alex Parker, who are you? And you're like, Leon Russom. And I was like, oh, you shaved and you look like a normal person. Okay, cool. I met you when you were playing Buckingham and you were totally different looking.
And of course, now I look like Santa Claus.
Yeah, you do. You do. And this is how I prefer you. I prefer you looking like Santa Claus. It makes me feel
jolly old blinded Santa Claus. Wandering the North Pole.
You would think that would make it harder to do such horrible things to you, but I feel like I learned about Santa too early in my age, and it really is. I'm taking it out on you.
Yes, well, there is that fatal hug.
Yes, oh, the hug. I'm so glad we found that.
It's cool to me to see these different ties and see these things that link up conversationally, because we talk about, you know, Gloucester, we talk about Richard III, who is this one of the earliest iterations of this archetype of the Machiavel that Shakespeare drew on again and again and again, and reached something of a final iteration in Edmund. You know, you talk about playing Ham in Endgame, you know, a play that would not have existed without King Lear.
Mm. None of
Beckett's longer works,
yeah,
you know, are drawn so specifically from Lear, had a tremendous impact on him. And that sense, you know, there's something of a synergy in the feeling of suffering between Gloucester and Lear, you know, and Ham.
There's a scene.
Use your head, can't you? Use your head, you're on Earth.
Right.
You cure for
and
that.
And it's all of a piece with things like poor forked animal as flies to wanton boys are we to the gods.
Yeah.
I mean, the tone is very similar to late Beckett.
Well, when we were...
And there's a moment there in 4-6, scene 4, act 4, scene 6, when Edgar, Gloucester, and Lear are all on stage, which feels, when you're doing it, like you just suddenly stepped into Beckett.
Yeah.
It's as though Beckett and Shakespeare crossed paths. Because, but all of the concern about the bodily decay and the overwhelming injustice in the world, Beckett's all about that.
Yeah.
And this play is all about that. I mean, hundreds of other themes going on, but more than anything in all of Shakespeare, I think the compassion for the basic humanity of people and how the world is indifferent to that.
Hmm.
Is present more in this play of Shakespeare's than in any other, I think.
When we were doing the table read, that was one of the very first things you said. We went through 4-6, and when Lear says, when we are born, we cry because we have come to this great stage of fools, and you were like, that's Beckett. And then someone was like, well no, Beckett, that's Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Beckett ripped it right into it.
Well, Beckett's is astride of the grave and a difficult birth.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Lingeringly, the grave digger puts on the 4-6.
Yep.
Which is
God.
I mean, that could fit right into Lear almost anywhere.
Absolutely.
And that was the landscape, you know, in terms of Beckett and seeing the devastation in
that's
Europe.
All Beckett could see.
Devastation.
Devastation.
Well, that's another thing. I was talking to somebody else about this play, and they were talking about how difficult it was to stage. And I went, why? Visually, it's the most empty play that Shakespeare ever wrote.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, you can play the whole thing on a flat surface.
Yeah, that was,
and your production, I think, is strengthened by that ethic that you guys just
bare stage it up.
Yeah, but deliberately, and then found other ways. You know, Tom has found other ways to bring in that aesthetic.
Yeah.
You know, and to say, you know, no, we're going to do a little bit of a deconstruction with the storm scene. We're going to do something deliberate with it, as opposed to just, well, we don't have a sound system, so drum on your thighs in the back. Like, we're going to make. Choices of it.
Whenever you're a company of, you know, limited financial means the way that we are, there's some productions where I feel that has sort of been an active hindrance, you know, where it's like, oh, I really wish that we had a little more money to do this or that, but with something like Lear, like you say, I think it really sort of lends itself to that, and I'm super glad that Thomas chose to go in that direction and lean into it rather than fight it. The McKellen production that you can watch on DVD, to me, that's even jarring when it cuts to the heath and they have, like, you know, hay and grass and, like, the sky-colored thing. It's weird to me. It's jarring. It's like, no, there's too much there. You can't, you know, you start to realize it minimizes it, you know, when you take it as literal as grass and shrubs and, you know, because it's like if this was a a movie, you'd have to David Lean it up, you know, you'd have to have the widest, most large possible, you know, little tiny people consumed by the landscape and stuff. And so when you get there halfway and it's, you know, a person, but it's, you know, sort of medium sized terrain and all that sort of stuff, to me it has a minimizing effect, whereas if it's just a bare stage, it's whatever you want. It's whatever you
need.
If
you guys haven't seen Ron Kurosawa,
Oh yeah.
The landscapes.
Well, Kurosawa is, I mean, he's probably done the best film Macbeth. And he's probably done the best film Lear.
Yeah.
And he doesn't use a word of Shakespeare. Really.
Curse him.
Which is really, you know, that's sacrilege to say. But
right.
But he found visual equivalents.
Yeah.
He did.
The Throne of Blood, the Macbeth, I'm a huge fan of, with the ghostly witch imagery in the forest and all that. And actually...
Lady Amslow's...
Yeah.
Yeah,
like a whispery walk.
And his death. That's a great improvement, because Shakespeare has them battle off stage and then bring on a head.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But when those arrows start flying through his neck, oh my God.
Unreal. But actually, the one Shakespeare that I've directed with the Porters was Macbeth. It was our...
Yeah, I recall. With Jack, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it was maybe second or third season. It was the first...
It was 08.
Yeah, you're right. It was the first instance of us having to spontaneously scramble and rearrange stuff because Charlie, our artistic director, booked work elsewhere. It's a tradition that we've become very familiar with.
I've never met this person.
No, Charlie was around.
I'm teasing.
Yeah.
He
hung around just long enough to get me roped in.
Yeah, exactly.
And then he left.
Like, peace. That's the way of Charlie. But so I was directing that show and actually stole shamelessly from Throne of Blood, because why not, you know? And it was one of those where it's like, it's so funny. It's the Tarantino role, where if you're going to steal, you make it a little more obscure, because, you know, Spielberg steals from the Wild One in Crystal Skull, and the internet just explodes and goes, oh, he thinks it's so clever with Marlon Brando over this and Shia LaBeouf. And then just everything in Tarantino's movies is, you know, borrowed from some more obscure thing, and nobody knows what it is. Nobody says a thing. But in the Macbeth, for the famous, you know, had I so sworn as you had done, I would have, you know, beat the baby against the rock, that speech. Normally it's either done with her, you know, being all in his face and angry, or with her being kind of sexy and teasing and all that kind of stuff. And I'm like, no, you know what, we're going to pull a little Kurosawa action here. And I just had her sit on her knees, looking out, facing away from him, speaking very quietly in the little geisha girl pose that he had Lady M doing for this. So she's just there, you know, on her knees with her hands on top, looking out, not making eye contact, you know, had I so sworn as you had done. And and Amanda Marquardt, who was playing Lady Macbeth, she didn't fight me on it. It was just, you know, a lot of a sort of like, where is this coming from? It's very unusual. What are you trying to do? And I'm like, you know, I just want to try something that's a little less expected. And if you've ever been in a fight with somebody and, you know, they turn away from you and go, okay, I mean, you know, do what you want to do. I'm not going to force you. I mean, you know, you're not exactly a man if you don't do it. That's to me, that's equally effective than, you know, getting in somebody's face. And I thought we, you know, her and I sort of worked out a really sort of nice way into that. But of course, like I said, it all began with Kurosawa, so takes all sorts.
It's interesting to me to sort of segue on that in terms of seeing, you know, I don't know that you and I have ever spoken at length, but I've seen you now in quite a few things over the years.
Sure.
And it was interesting to me coming to this and saying, like, oh, they cast, you know, Gus as Edgar, and I think of you as... you know, we may actually share some predilections, but I think of you as a character actor and as the guy that's going to make the unanticipated choice, that's going to do, you know, the thing that's going to search for something that's sort of outside of the pale, what the audience is going to expect. And I thought, oh, he's just going to go buck-ass wild with Tom of Bedlam. Like, he's going to be climbing the walls. And you didn't. And you... underplayed it and found a note with him that I thought was wonderful. It just wasn't what I thought I was going to see you do. Yeah. And I was like, son of a bitch, he did it again. He surprised. I thought he was going to go big, and he didn't. you know, again, defying the expectation. But I felt that the whole family, that the three of you together in this tragicomic circumstance where there are these very bizarre interactions and where you have, you know, the faux madman leading the blind man, and, you know, and then off on the other end you have this sort of arc villain that is maneuvering in the world, this predatory figure, that there was this there was a great deal of shared humanity and a sense of a family history in it. And I felt like these were three people that had been endowed with a sense of having grown up in a household, or of having this history and this groundedness for each other.
Well, that's fascinating, because in point of fact, after the first couple of acts, Edmund and Edgar are almost never on stage together.
Mm-hmm.
And after the first couple of acts, Gloucester and Edmund are never on stage together. I mean, and Edmund are never on stage. And Edgar and Gloucester only meet, that we see, after he's blind.
Yeah.
And he never knows who it is.
We get no stasis scene together. We get no establishing.
In fact, that's one of the things I find astonishing, that sometimes people, well, sometimes, almost always, people, when they write about the play, they want to know about the fairy tale beginning, you know, about, is it arbitrary? Do you just do it artificially? Because I find it so hard to believe, you know, that a man would divide his kingdom this way, and it's like something out of the Brothers Grimm or something. and so you think of the play, because of what other people have said, as being very exposition heavy. But in point of fact, it's astonishing the way he just cuts into things midway. I mean, I was watching the other night and I suddenly realized, the first time you see Edgar, he's being chased off the stage by Edmund going, get the fuck out of here.
Mm.
You know? We never established who is that?
Yeah.
You know? And
But to that point, and it was something that that Thomas and I discussed, you know, sort of at length at the beginning, because it's this weird thing of why isn't Edgar in that first scene?
Mm,
you know,
yeah.
Everybody's there. Everybody in the damn play is there, and why isn't he there? And, you know, it was the conversation, you know, should we stick you there? Should we put you in the back? And it's sort of like, I feel like it means something that he's not there. And that's sort of where we agreed that the jumping off point with the character was, is that he's super aloof, you know? He's, we both kept not wanting to use the word douchey, but it's like, it's that sort of, when you are a douche by dint of your own given circumstance, as opposed to something that you've reached on your own. You know, Edgar's a good guy. He turns out to be the sort of hero of the piece structurally, and but it's like at the beginning, I feel like it's a lot of, you know, oh, I wake up at 11 o'clock and I go for my spa routine,
yeah,
and then I
there was a sense of him as a little bit of a dilettante.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When he came in with, you know, the foil
that's
and the fencing outfit, it's
douche.
Like he's, you know, like, oh yeah, he got to get in his Pilates,
yeah,
you know,
no, exactly.
And then he had a quick spa, you know, and now he's gonna pop back to his room. There's a bar in there. It's a little bar. It's a wet bar. It's not the full thing, but he's gonna, you
but
know.
It's there.
You know, he's going to brush up a little bit, and then he's got an evening of socializing.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think that was how I justified not being in the first scene, and I think that ties right into that he needs to be taken down a couple of pegs, and it's a question that Harold Bloom talks about in The Invention of the Human. It's like, when he goes into hiding, you know, he could have done anything. He could have gone anywhere. He could have, you know, been in touch with any number of people. He could have, you know, chosen. He chooses the worst, you know, most self-flagellating possible thing to do. Is like, you know, okay, I've been cast out of my house. Obviously, the first thing I'm going to do is throw all my clothes away and pretend to be a crazy beggar person and live in a hovel in the storm. That is the, like, logical thing that has to happen here. So it's sort of like coming from the place of privilege to me that it made a little more sense of, you know, I've been knocked down so thoroughly, I've been run out of my own house, and there is that element. I don't even know if it's conscious on his part at that moment, but to take the basest possible way out, and then through that, you know, he's able to build himself back up into a real person and not this, you know, aloof Paris Hilton type that he starts out as at the beginning. But that was my sort of way around that. And if it plays, you know, to the audience in some fashion, that's great. I've always had a problem with people sticking people in scenes when they're not written there. There was a production of Romeo and Juliet that some of my friends did, and they're like, we're going to put Balthazar in the, you know, in the tomb scene at the end when everybody comes in. And my buddy who was playing the part goes, I don't think you want to do that. And he's like, no, it's fine. You know, it's, I know it's not written that way, but we'll just put him there. And I go, okay. And the scene starts, and they enter the tomb, and the guy just goes, no! And runs over to Romeo and starts cradling him and sobbing and all that. And the director goes, okay, yeah, you're right. Maybe we won't put you in the scene.
Well, I actually have a quarrel with what we do. It's not a big one. It doesn't really matter a lot. But I think Shakespeare's very carefully seen to it that Edmund and Lear are never on stage together.
Mm-hmm.
And we have him hovering in the opening scene, and I don't know that I agree with that. I don't think it's a deal breaker, so I've never said anything about it until just this moment. but it's very interesting. The moment that he's taken off stage, Edmund, and he's dying, and he's never going to return, is followed instantly by howl, howl, yep. howl.
There.
And the same thing sort of happens with Gloucester. At the top of the play, he has this rather engaging thing about, you know, I had this fling, and this is the result of it, and you're not too sure whether that's not really sleazy.
Yeah.
We play it like a joke.
Yeah.
Like we're used to that. But no, totally. Inside, I'm like, you're a dick.
Yeah. Well, I'm doing this
right in front of you. Right in front of me. Like, come on, Dad.
And, but it's funny because, I mean, that's kind of interesting. You kind of go, oh, let's see this. And then suddenly Gloucester goes, the king is coming, and gets the hell off stage. But it's as though Shakespeare went, I got you interested in this. Now, I don't want you to continue to be interested. Get off stage.
Yeah.
Because we're going to go here. And it's as though he has his own spotlight and is going to, like, make you look at what he wants you to look at. So I think it's very important. And, of course, we have corrupted texts, so it doesn't make sense to say this. But I think that he meant, I want these people on stage and only these. Except when he says lords and ladies and stuff.
Right. Here's the thing, though. I actually, because I fought Thomas on that for a little while, too, about me being on stage whenever Lear enters, because there's only one scene where Edmund and Lear are on stage together, and it's when Edmund leads on Cordelia and Lear as prisoners.
Right.
And after a little bit of discussion with Thomas, we came to a point where it was like, no, this is going to be good. And how I justify being there in that opening scene is when Lear and Kent have their argument, and I see Lear command Kent, like, on your allegiance, hear me, and Kent goes to the floor. Edmund, being, as far as I can tell, extremely sexual, gets a huge rise out of seeing somebody dominate another person like that. And so by staying in that opening scene and seeing this king command a man to his knees and then kick him the fuck out of the kingdom, I get a huge rise out of that watching it. And then it really plays in, it helps me play in for that scene in 5-3 when they're let in and I see this guy who just earlier was the king is now on his knees before me. It just, that's how that plays out for me.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
And there's a interesting thing that a man named Stanley Cavell wrote an essay called Disowning Knowledge. And it's almost a book-length essay, but the first two chapters of it are on Lear.
Hmm.
And among the things he points out, almost everybody, if you say King Lear, you think, oh God, bleak, cruel, empty, loveless, all these negative things. And he points out that there is very rarely a character on stage that's as loved as Lear is.
Mm.
Kent will do anything for him. Cordelia will do anything for him. Gloucester is blinded and ultimately dies for him. The amount of affection in the play is amazing. And the Edgar character in particular, by the way he looks after his father and the other folks around him, because he also handles Lear quite wonderfully, is like a well of compassion in the center of this play that's supposed to be bleak and cruel. And I think that this production catches some of that I don't think I've really seen in other productions.
I definitely take issue with people's interpretation of Lear as this hopeless or annihilating play. I don't think that it is. I think that it's ultimately redemptive. But you can read it as annihilating if you choose to.
It's sexy to do so in our century.
Yeah. Well, yes, that's true. I do want to speak to, though, to the beginning, because it's interesting to me in this high tragic period that Shakespeare got to this point of this very loose command of the archetypes that he was working with, of the ideas and sort of tropes that he was bringing back, and his like cold opens. You know, like you talk about starting with this little bit of a tease of, you know, that's like we start off with this glimpse of this character, and if you imagine seeing it for the first time, you know, right off the bat, you're like, oh, he's a bastard. So he's either super noble or he's going to burn the world down in Shakespeare's plays. Like, he's either, you know, Falconbridge, or he is this destructor figure.
Mm-hmm.
And then we kind of smash cut to, like, Lear, who is at the height of his hubris, like, right at this tipping point of the waning of his powers, the same way Macbeth starts.
Mm.
And, you know, the only pre-intervention words of Macbeth's we get are "so fair and foul a day I have not seen." You know, that's all that we get of him before he has this prophecy dropped in his lap. You know, Shakespeare was at this point where he was in a seat of mastery where he was going to attack right at what was interesting to him. He drops into Othello mid-plot.
Yeah.
You know. Mm-hmm. So that's fascinating to me. And then he sets off all of these arcs swinging in these different directions. They're complementary.
Right.
You know, I love this idea, Gus, that you were just talking about this sort of dilettante Edgar who comes into his own through this self-abasement, because that sort of mirrors what happens to Lear. Mm. You know, he finds his humanity through shedding his kingship and becoming poor and broken and put upon, and then in the end he's able to let go of his kind of earthly power and recognize the beauty of this very pure daughter, you know, this very loving figure that he has, recognize the love of Kent that you were just talking about.
Isn't it interesting and horrifying how nobody ever changes, ever? I mean, humanity.
Yeah. All right, yeah.
It's like, oh, these problems are so different than what we're dealing with today.
Right. It's fucking scary is what it is.
And one of the things that lately has come to fore for me is we talk about the characters as though they were fixed, as though they were not creatures that alter before our eyes. And you mentioned the Bloom invention of humanity, or whatever, I can't remember how he phrases it, of the human. I was thinking when you were talking about doing Richard, that those are the first times that we see the inwardness of a character.
Yes.
Where Richard, very early play, is telling the audience what he's going to do and improvising it as he is saying it. He doesn't know what he's going to do until he said it.
He doesn't know what it'll cost him.
He reflects on his own thoughts, and then that breeds other thoughts. And we see that process going on. And it culminates, of course, in Hamlet, where all of a sudden it isn't about manipulating things out here. It's going very deep into the most basic things, like why live? Why continue to live?
Also, Gatto, if I may, I can't go on. Must go on.
But the thing that I find fascinating is that the characters change from scene to scene or within scenes, and to try to talk about them as fixed personalities is, I think, ultimately a little fruitless. I think that the best way to approach Shakespeare is that you walk on as just a naked creature, whatever costume you're wearing, but you don't have
unnecessary
quote, characteristics, and you live through it, and that tells you who you are, And then, having done that in rehearsal, you can then go back at the beginning and go, oh, well, then I must be this.
Yeah.
But that you start bare-assed. And if you don't, then you're probably not going to find much of what he wrote.
Mm-hmm. No, that's brilliant. I've never heard it put like that, but I mean, yeah, if you go into it, you know, think, okay, I'm Richard III, so I'm going to be super cocky and evil and arrogant, then, yeah, you're dead in the water, you know, there's nothing, you know.
Well, you put perimeters all over yourself before you've even started.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I must say, Bloom was the first one that pointed that out to me, that when you're listening to any of the great soliloquies, you're listening to somebody actually think before you. I mean,
yeah,
you're seeing the interior of someone's mind,
yeah.
Which of course is why, and in America, of course, you'll get huge, huge flack if you say this, but it's the reason why basically there is no subtext in Shakespeare. If he wants to show you what's going on inside somebody, he shows you.
Yeah. No, it's I get the flack, but it's also something that I totally agree with. I had a brilliant teacher at one point in my life where he was talking about that exact thing, and it's like, you know, it's that, and then the lack of stage direction, you know, it all ties into the same thing, but his line was, you know, in Shakespeare, if someone, you know, goes up to you with a dagger and their line is die, unless your line is no, you die, you had better bloody well die.
That's great. I've gotten into some fairly prolonged arguments over the subtext question, and I think that Shakespeare was a brilliant dramatist, a revolutionary dramatist in terms of the machinery of the play, the engine of the play. But he was his greatest achievement, I think, was as a poet. And there are some plays, yes, like I believe that Lear is a play for me in terms of what I have seen, in terms of, you know, working with scene work over the years. I've never actually done the play, but it's one of the first plays that comes to my mind when I think of an example of a play that in my mind is a more resonant poem than it is a dramatic work. That's an opinion, and other people have different opinions.
That is one of the things that's led so many critics to say that it can never be as good on stage as it is in the study. And I think that may be true of every play.
Every screenplay, every teleplay.
You have the time to think about it and mull every subtle point. You couldn't do that as a play is moving in front of you.
Well, here's something, though. This is not at all an original idea, but plays were not meant to be read. They were meant to be seen. But as you say with King Lear, I think it's one of the few plays, even amongst Shakespeare's 38 that he has down, I don't think there are many that compare as far as reading King Lear. Like, obviously, before we do any play, we all sit down and read them. I assume most of us read them privately, and then we all get together and read them as a group. When I sit down and read King Lear, it's totally fine. It's beautiful. If I sit down and read, like when I read Troilus and Cressida, there are some wonderful moments. But the poetry for Lear, just it's a step above.
Like you say, Alex, it does work in and of itself in a way that maybe some of the plays don't. You know, you can sit down and just read one of them totally cold and be a little baffled, you know, a little sort of lost. But for me, Lear is you know, I don't know, it's like Cormac McCarthy, you know, it's like reading The Road, like you say, it's a elongated, you know, it's the Odyssey, it's an epic poem, you know, basically. And then with something like The Road, you know, they make a movie, and it was a very good movie, but then, again, you literalize it, and in that, you take it down a peg just by nature, you know. Oh, now the man is Viggo Mortensen. and now, you know, this set is art designed, and I can see it, and he looks like a homeless person, and obviously that's what he would look like, but, you know, in your head, it's a million things, and none of those things all at once.
Well, the madness, too, I mean, reading those scenes of madness with Tom of Bedlam and Lear, you're reading it and you're like, this is fucking crazy, but it's beautiful.
Yeah, and if you think about the impact that those scenes by themselves, you know, have had on other art, you know, it, without one obscure reference that Tom of Bedlam has to a British fairy tale spawned Robert Browning's epic poem, which spawned Stephen King's seven novel,
yes.
like, center of his yes. fictional world.
Yeah.
Like, people are what? Still rolling with that. You
well,
know?
When we have uncorrupted copies, and when we are relatively uncorrupted, and when we have the best of Shakespeare, I think that you're exactly bang on about them being great poems. The miracle of Shakespeare is that they're great dramatic poems, so that you can literally, as Kurosawa has proved, you can take the poetry out, and the structure is a matter of poetry.
Yes.
And will work in the great ones, the greatest ones. And so to me, it's just insane to think of going into trying to do Shakespeare and not starting with the words and not starting with regular iambs and then finding out where the poem disrupts itself. And then it's almost like surgeon first do no harm. Before you start laying choices on it, you got to find out where he already did your work for you. You don't have to do anything except say the damn words and get out of their way. And playing Shakespeare is a wonderful example of that. When there are three or four times when they take the example and go, act this full out with all the passion you can muster.
Right. Yeah.
And then just say it. And invariably, the just saying it works better.
Yeah.
And affects you more. Mm. I'm sorry, I almost...
No. Well, speaking to the question of subtext, the first example that I always bring up is the Brutus Cassius tent scene, where afterwards we find out that that Portia is dead. Mm. And retroactively, to me, that informs the entire... And even Cassius is like, how did I escape killing? Like, how did I... We have this... I'm like, okay, well, so that's something that the actor needs to know during the scene before the character says it.
Right.
So there is that sort of the literal dynamic of working with the subtext, where sometimes I feel like it's necessitated that it's there, but there is a more vague, unconscious subtext in terms of when you just approach the language, there's a poetic resonance that just triggers stuff in you, that just triggers sort of primordial imagery, especially in high tragedies, especially in a Lear or in a Macbeth. You know, this is a play that when I read it, or when I'm in a reading of it, you know, anytime I'm interacting with that language, it suddenly returns me to my personal place in the cosmos.
Right.
And it causes me to think about the hour of my dying, which will come, you know, and what will I have held dear by that. Like, it's the power of poetry to return us to those elemental questions. And I feel like there is a sort of subtext in that that's less literal than the method actor's interpretation of, like, well, I'm thinking about my mother.
Well, I think what happens is that the subtext arises. That if you put yourself through trying to live those words, then the subtext hits you. You don't have to go looking for it. It finds you.
Yeah.
And I'll give you an example. To me... We're only going to do it one more time, so now I can talk about it.
Yeah, right. That's
me,
why I'm here.
To me, the apex, the moment when I am most involved in this play as Gloucester, is a silent moment when in 4-6, when Lear recognizes Gloucester, when he finally says, "I know you," and we were in performance. It was like the third week, and he said that line. And he's straddling me in our production. And he lifted up my head as he was saying it. And I just broke and began to sob. And I have no eyes. So you have this spectacle of a crying man who can't cry, literally. And it just shot through me. And I never expected that. But all the way through, he's so concerned about the king. We've got to save the king. He's so dedicated to order and authority and this particular person's authority. And he lets himself be blinded for it. And then the king touches him by acknowledging that he exists. And that's, from that point on, he can die because he's gotten what he needed. And I could never have arrived at that by thinking.
Yeah, yeah, you know, you talk about how it finds you, and I had that exact same thing happen to me for this production as well. After opening weekend, I had this big long talk with Thomas, and I called Charlie on the phone too. I was like, I'm not good. I don't know what I'm doing. I have no idea what's going on. And it was during this, I ended up going back to the text, as we should. For that whole week, I spent hours a day just re-going over my lines, looking at everyone else's lines, trying to find something. I was like, I feel like it's all there, but there's one link missing, and if you have one link missing, it's all fucking, it's done. And I didn't find anything the whole week. I was like, I don't know what I'm looking for, and I'm not finding it. And it was the second Sunday that we did, it would be the sixth performance, when I show you the letter, your Gloucester has this anger streak, where you very, very violently, every once in a while, a line comes out of you that's just terrifying. And your line is, wind me into him, and you just scream it at me. And immediately when you did that, that was when I first found the whole, like, hunching, like, hiding kind of a thing. And it totally brought together this whole alternate character for Edmund whenever he's around Gloucester and Edgar and everybody. He's very hunched and subdued, and he does this whole thing. And I would have never found that just by thinking about it. It just didn't occur to me. And it's hugely based upon you as well. I mean, if your character didn't have that aspect of it, I don't know what I would have fucking done with this production. But the fact that you had this anger streak in you and gave me a reason to be just subdued because I was like feigning fear of you to give you this sense of confidence and overbearing of me,
Just for the listener, Alex is so tall.
I'm so tall. That too.
Like, this like tall, like blade
and
thin.
And sometimes gets shorter than me on stage.
Exactly.
Which is
because,
very hard to do.
Yeah.
He becomes a question mark.
I
sort of like.
I really do. And that's another thing. Like, if this entire cast, Lear, Larry Cedar is the only one, and Jamie, who plays Kent, they're both about 6'2 as well. But everyone else in this play is several inches shorter than me. And that played into it as well. It really did. And I feel like Edmund, being the sociopath that he is, it really plays into it very well that he is, you're playing two characters. And before I did this play, I did the Paris Letter, where it's written that everybody in the play plays two separate roles in two different time periods. And I don't think that I could have approached Edmund nearly the same way that I have been if I hadn't done that before and realized, like, he's two people. He is somebody when he's by himself, he is who he really is, and he's just this fucking bastard. And then whenever he's around other people, he's truly feigning this thing that everyone's like, oh, he's nothing. And by subduing myself and really getting shorter than you to make you feel... I feel like when... Because I really feel like you think of Edgar and myself as children still. I mean, we talked about that. You still think we're like 12 years old, but suddenly we're in our mid-20s and like we've grown up and the fuck you, old man. Like, shit's right. Gonna get real if we want it to. But if Edgar's over here being this douchey guy and still acting like this kid he was when he was 16 years old because he just has that, that's how he is. And if Edmund just plays like, no, you're right, you're still totally in power of me, but if I'm in power of you and you don't understand it's coming, it brings a whole level.
Yeah,
that's
absolutely,
you know. It feels very much like, to me, Edmund thrives when chaos kind of rises, when that position of power in King Lear sort of separates and
he gets such a hard on.
Well, yeah, I mean, the power fractures, right? There's no head, there's nothing to fear, there's nothing to keep you in line. I think that's one thing that's very interesting about this show is that you guys are very much fallout of what's happening over here with the main tragedy, and it sort of ripples through.
Oh, none of this would happen to us.
Right.
It's sort of like upstairs, downstairs. We're downstairs, mm-hmm. and Lear and his family are upstairs. If he hadn't created chaos, then none of this would happen.
That's another thing with the first scene where I talked about how I did come to the conclusion that I do enjoy being forced into that scene as well. I feel like Edmund, when he was away, definitely put some thought into how he's going to make his situation better when he gets home. Mm-hmm. But by witnessing this crazy act of Lear dividing up his kingdom and giving it to these people, I feel like that's where he goes, okay, I have been thinking about how I'm going to make my situation better. I need to just make my situation better now, because shit's getting crazy.
There's this great line in the film The Master that came out recently. It's right near the end, and he says, when you've found a way to live without a master, you come back and you let us know.
Yeah.
And I feel like the master's taken away in King Lear.
Yes.
And nobody has that framework to follow anymore. And that makes everybody's humanity sort of like comes into light then. We don't have that figurehead to look up to anymore. It's really interesting to me, the dynamic, I think.
Well, it takes you to a very archaic place in your mind and in the mise-en-scene, because I think firmly in Shakespeare's mind, the more I read him, that he thought that without that authority, then you do have chaos. Mm-hmm. I mean, he would not be a Democrat.
I think that is a longer conversation
than we
have time for.
Of course, he would have had all these centuries to evolve. But I think that one of the principal themes that's throughout all of his work is how can you be a leader and not become a tyrant? And is it possible for there to be leadership dispersed? Because in almost all the plays, like Caesar, and anytime that happens, chaos happens. And you either have a good tyrant or a bad tyrant, but that a tyrant is necessary. And that's not something we want to think. But I suspect that's there. I want to do one quick footnote. When I said the thing about discovering 3 weeks in that there was this emotional burst, that sounds like a pleasant thing for the actor and maybe something for the audience. But what confirmed that it was right was Larry's very next line is, we cry when we are come to this great stage of fools.
Yeah.
And he suddenly is nurturing to me. Lear in this play nurtures no one. I mean, he's in so much in need that everyone has to nurture him. And so it played into giving Larry a great moment that didn't have a bottom to it until that moment.
I'd actually like to pose the sort of counter side to what Leon and Alex are talking about in terms of it's not possible to know it or reason it out until you feel it, which I totally believe, especially with Shakespeare. But I actually had a bit of the opposite experience with this particular show. Because one of the reasons that I wanted to give this role a go, and it plays into what you were saying earlier about me getting cast as this and being Edgar and being Tom and all that sort of stuff. As a board member with the Porters, I'm in a sort of unique, advantageous position where I have a bit of an inside track in terms of what Gus the actor is going to be doing with any given show. With this one, Thomas was a little more cagey than usual. He really wasn't. He was being tight-lipped, and I was playing it cool. I'm like, you're gonna put me in the show, right? But there were a couple of roles that I was looking at and that I was interested in, even before this became literal, just back when we were in very, very early talks with Larry and it was an idea and all this kind of stuff. And there were a couple of roles that I was pretty confident that I could do. Everything's a process and sometimes you fail when you don't expect it, but a couple of roles that I was reasonably sure that I could just kind of come in and do without a lot of effort. But the thing to me that was so interesting about this guy was, and stay with me here, there's not a lot of arcs in Shakespeare. It just kind of wasn't a standard of the time. Nowadays you try to write a studio movie, what's the arc? Like, oh, well, he's a down on his luck waiter, and then he turns out to be the chosen one. Saves the world. Okay, super. In Lear, people have a tragic fall, or they reach some sort of apotheosis, or they confront their own whatever it is. That's the sort of standard Shakespearean track for the characters, but rarely in the text, you have somebody that starts out as one thing and then ends up as a completely different thing without then dying immediately, And so that was what was appealing to me, was the idea of this guy that starts out, you know, aloof and nebbish and, you know, whatever you want to say, and then ends up as the guy that sort of has to be the guy and save the day and all that. But because of the fact, you know, like we were talking about, that the early scenes are so scattershot and sparse with his involvement, with me, it really was having to sit down and sort of intellectually reason out, okay, he is here in this scene, and then all this time passes, and he has to sort of be here in this scene, and we don't get to see the in-between.
Yeah, the Lady M challenge.
We don't, you know, get to see, I don't get to do that on stage in front of people, and so for the first couple of weeks, I was freaked out by the, by the fact of, like, is this working? Is this its own, you know, is the string there? The beads are there, the individual thing, you know, is there a through line? Because in my head, I know that each little beat is sort of where it needs to be, but because of the sort of mosaic nature of it, I really didn't have a sense of, is this a character, is this a through line, until maybe halfway through, and until it started to sort of feel right for me, and that was the first time ever that I've had an experience like that, where I just sort of have to trust my brain when it comes to very kind of gut emotional, you know, this is where your character needs to be at this, and then it gets easier as the show goes on, because there's a little more consistency with him sort of being on stage and completing that journey and all the rest of it. But yeah, like I say, just a very sort of singular experience in terms of piecing it together, and you know, it's like doing a mosaic where you're not allowed to step back, you know. You look real close and assemble all the little pieces and then step back and hope that it makes a picture. So a bit of the, you know, opposite of the usual.
It would be fascinating, I think, to see, to track Edgar. He becomes king, mm-hmm, when it's all over, and you know, the whole Prince Hal evolution that happens in Henry IV,
one and two,
and five. It would be fascinating to track Edgar that way and find out how what he does in when he's poor Tom and all the different people that he becomes, how those lead to him becoming a candidate as an effective leader.
Yeah. Well, I feel like the arcs that they have, I think these are great characters, particularly Edgar and Edmund, to be talking about process, to be talking about what you bring to it from the beginning. And the arcs in this play are complementary, and they describe the wheel. You know, it is the wheel of fire. It is the wheel that comes full circle. You have, you know, Gloucester, Lear, Edgar, who have to descend, who fall, and then who rise back up by dint of what they experience as transcendent at their bottom. Mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, you know, you have Goneril, Regan, Edmund, who rise, who achieve the sort of summit in the world through cruelty and through the shortcuts that they take.
Right.
And their sort of natural gifts and predatory natures and
that too whack is, themselves. That too is part of what I think is fascinating about a character not being a fixed entity,
mm-hmm,
but an evolving one in front of your eyes. Mm-hmm. Because the women aren't here, we haven't talked about Goneril and Regan much. But I doubt seriously if the Regan that you see in the first act
is capable
has
of
any
the blind
notion,
yeah,
that she's capable of plucking out a man's eyes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really felt that in this production, and I feel like usually I see Goneril and Regan played as though they're already there.
Right.
That was something we had to talk about very early on as well. The first time before Charlie left, he saw our first run-through off book, and he gave a few notes to people, and he told me, the first thing he said to me was like, "I knew you were evil immediately." And I was like, oh yeah, I guess I was playing Edmund for 1-2 already in 1-1. And he was like, "Yeah, I don't think that's right." And I was like, "No, you're absolutely right. I shouldn't be this fucking dick in 1-1 when people are first meeting me. It just doesn't work that way." And that works very well for Regan as well. If she's coming across as this woman capable of ripping a man's eyes out from the very beginning, I mean, how are you? Why would you watch that? I mean, there's nothing to see happen.
Yeah.
It's already happened.
Well, these characters, particularly the Machiavels, but it's interesting to me that when Shakespeare approaches Edmund, you know, he gives him a brother who has a different iteration of the same gift. They're both brilliant improvisers, and they're both brilliant performers. But it's necessity that urges that, I think. You could make a different choice, but it's the circumstance where Edgar kind of finds this gift in himself and goes through this transformation, and whereas Edmund, you know, has this awareness that all of the Machiavels have of their ability to manipulate and their ability to maneuver people. He's a little bit more understandable than, for example, an Iago, where Shakespeare gives us no explanation, no origin.
Right.
No mirror anywhere around him.
Something I thought about a lot was the fact that versus the Edmund-Edgar relationship is that everything that Edmund does is a conception. Everything that Edgar does is based on necessity. Edmund doesn't need to do any of this. He just recognizes these things in himself and puts them to work. Edgar doesn't even recognize that he has these abilities, and they come to him through need. Did you feel that as well?
Yeah, they're being forced into the... Yeah, and it's...
You react. Edmund creates, Edgar reacts, and it's just the way they work in tandem with each other.
Yeah, until the sort of tipping point when he takes charge, and it might not really even be until the Oswald encounter, and I read the letter.
First take charge.
That's when it's like, shit, because, you know, again, you talk about discovering things along the way that you should have known all along. I had a revelation. I shouldn't even say this out loud. I had a little thing last night where I was just like, you know, wait, at what point does he recognize the entirety of who is behind this and why? And, you know, it's late. I think textually, you know, it's late. It's around the Oswald thing, I think. Until that point, it's like, oh, a conspiracy, and it's that sort of vague, you know, the man is out to get me kind of thing, and he doesn't realize really the specifics until that point. And then, you know, it's right after that scene that that he comes into the camp with the letter and says, you know, it's right after that his plan, you know, becomes active. So I think that's textually supported, but it's just one of those interesting. But to your earlier point about the whole Mad Tom thing and the improvisy performy thing, and also it ties into what you were saying about me not being totally off the wall as an actor during those scenes. That was something that I always struggled with as an audience member watching the show, be it live or filmed, because I feel like, and this is something I talked to Thomas about super early, it might have even been before the first read, I sent him an email, where I just said, like, I've always struggled with when they are Mad Tom, because it comes across, you know, we've seen this guy in a couple of scenes, he's privileged, he's sheltered, he's all these things, and then suddenly he's also the most brilliant actor in the world, because, you know...
Yeah, he's Andy Serkis.
Yeah, exactly.
Because performers, I think, get a little drunk on, you know, ooh, I get to be crazy, and I get to wear a loincloth, and my hair is nuts, and all this, and sort of disregard the, you know, the reality of who this guy is. And so I wanted to play it as though, you know, like you say, it was that sort of grounded, super desperate need to pass myself off as this... you know, thing, as opposed to, you know, showcase for my acting talents. Because I think that's really the trap that a lot of people fall into, and I was very keen to avoid that. And so hopefully everything is coming, you know, I wanted it to play more like it's sort of a desperate con, you know? It's like, what's the basest example? Ghost Protocol, when Tom Cruise and the guys are in the hotel room, and they don't know if the other team knows their faces or not, and they're like, okay, we just have to go in and hope for the best, and it's that whole really well-directed, super tense scene where they're just having to, you know, play the guy, and I'm hoping it comes across more like that, as opposed to, you know, look at my brilliant disguise, and yes, how good I'm acting, you know, all that kind of stuff, so...
You said back 20 minutes or so ago about the about how he doesn't need to, but he chooses the most difficult possible path. Viewing it from the outside, what it looks like to me when I watch it happening is that there is nowhere to go, that Lear's power extends to the water's edge. that Kent has to literally get the fuck out of the country. I mean, he's got to go across water. And, of course, France is across water. But everything that is within, where you wouldn't get in a ship or a spaceship, is Lear's land.
Yeah.
So there is no place to hide.
Mm-hmm. What I love about the inference of it, what it says to me is that this person looks around at the world and says, what will blend in? What will go unnoticed in Lear's
human English? Misery will go unnoticed.
Miserable, schizophrenic, like shouting on the
that
street corner.
Funny.
Like that
what
is
you do unnoticed.
That is the most that's blending in this world. That has been
I think that's blending in any
lived,
world.
I
don't pay attention to those
it,
people.
And at my age, it's highly unlikely that I will ever play Edgar.
No, we'll do the show again. You can
but
do it.
The but. The,
tonight, one last
all
show.
Those,
one last
all
show.
Those scenes with Lear and the Fool and Kent for a fugitive to be sitting next to... And you were not present when he abdicated.
Right.
Now, that doesn't mean you don't know it, but it does mean that we didn't experiencing you know it.
Mm.
So you're there, the best buddy, all of a sudden, of the number one authority figure in your universe, and you're a fugitive. Must be so on, so right at the edge of things all the time.
Yeah,
you know, it would be fun once to live through that, just to find out what that.
Just
like.
Once though, we were talking about just throwback a little bit. We were talking about the whole upstairs downstairs thing. I think it's important to note that King Lear is the only play that Shakespeare wrote, the tragedy, that has a subplot, which you just don't find very often, and obviously. We are the subplot of King Lear. And through talking to people, Jamie in particular I had a good conversation with about this. He drew the subplot from Sir Philip Sidney's Arcadia. In Arcadia, it was written in the late 1500s, English, but it was set in ancient Greece. So all the characters... obviously, he changed all the names. I'll use the names people are familiar with. Gloucester. When we meet Gloucester, it's in Book 2, Chapter 10. It's just this like thing. You can read it in like 10 minutes. You meet Gloucester in this rainstorm. There are these two characters hiding under a rock, which is where people believe Shakespeare discovered the hovel. And you see Gloucester, this blinded man, and his younger son leading him. And they come in under the rock, and they tell their story about how Gloucester has this bastard son. And in the story, the son blinds him himself, tricks Gloucester into believing Edgar is a bad guy. Edgar gets kicked out. Then Edmund goes in and blinds Gloucester himself and kicks him out of the city. They are then leading around in this rainstorm. Gloucester is trying to convince Edgar to lead him up to the top of this rock so that he can jump off and die. And in this story, whenever the rainstorm ends, they go back to the city with an army and retake the city. Edmund gets overthrown. Gloucester dies out of joy because his son is placed in his proper place, but Edmund does not die. In this story, Edmund, after his father dies, Edmund convinces Edgar that he's fine, and he ends up becoming Edgar's number two man. That's like, I think that's so amazing that he's just so brilliant that he completely overruns the city, gets retaken over, but then convinces his brother, no, I'm not a bad guy. No, it's cool. I'll be your number two general guy. It's fine. I think that's very interesting.
There is an, I mean, we're nearly out of time, but there's something so satisfying that Shakespeare creates this villain, and finally there is someone to oppose him. Because so much of the horror of Othello is that he drops this monster into this play with just nobody to stand up, nobody to recognize what he is doing, nobody to stop what he's doing. You know, if you were to swap Othello and Hamlet, both of those plays would solve themselves in an act. You know, Claudius would be dead before the ghost finished speaking.
Yeah, right.
And Hamlet would see through Iago in, like, a speech. You know, he'd be like, okay, all right. Like, what does Iago do with a man that cannot be played upon as easily as a pipe? You know? So, but Shakespeare will drop, these characters drop Richard into this world that is not ready for him, you know. And finally, here we have... we genuinely have an opposite, you know, in Edgar that can lay him low. And at the end, there's not this unsettling, you know, sense of, like, yeah, Iago's, he's probably going to be tortured to death, but...
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Like, they say that, but I always read the end of that play, and there's this little sliver of, like...
He gets away?
He's still out there.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, he's like, the Joker laughing, being dragged off by the police, you know, like, destined to do this forever.
Yeah.
That it's a fascinating thing, the Iago trickery. The Raul Julia played Othello in the Park. Richard Dreyfuss played Iago.
What?
Bruce McGill played the gull. Is it Benvolio? Is
Cassio? That
Rodrigo.
Rodrigo, yes.
Rodrigo. John Hurd played Cassio.
Mm.
Okay. I saw it. It was one of the worst productions I have ever seen in my life. But
Bruce, so right? That's yeah, the tension is high.
But Bruce McGill...
How many awards did they win?
But Bruce McGill, who people might now know as the Secretary of War in Lincoln, but was also the guy who played the William Tell Overture on his throat in Animal House. Yes. He was covering.
Yes.
He was covering Richard Dreyfuss, and Dreyfuss played it almost like a stand-up comic. He was so in control and took the piss out of Raoul constantly, and Raoul just looked like an idiot. So I was talking with Bruce after the show, and I said, "If you get to go on, please play an honest Iago. Don't make such a fool of him." And so Bruce called me 3 days later, and Dreyfuss had put his hand through a plate glass window, and he wasn't going to be able to go on. So he said, "Come see me play an honest Iago." All of a sudden, it was the best Othello I've ever seen in my life, because he wasn't taking the easy, cheap shots. And all of a sudden, the grand romanticism that Raoul was doing made sense. And the evil was worse, because he pushed the evil so far back that it was when he turned on Amelia and almost hit her that you went, oh, this is a dangerous guy.
Yeah, you only see what he really is a very, very few times in that play.
And it then, of course, it also made Hurd, who I thought was the most radical thing in it of all, he's playing Cassio, which I always thought was, it's a part I never wanted to play because I thought it was so boring. But when he gets drunk, John was a drunk. And so he understood about the chemical change.
Yeah.
And so as he got drunk, he got mean. And he became a truly nasty drunk. And all of a sudden, these were real people instead of a bull and a toreador. And it was fascinating to watch. All it took was Bruce just altering the chemistry slightly, and the whole play became brilliant. And it had been appalling before.
Yeah.
There was an Othello. You can find it. It's on DVD. But '80s maybe. Where's Anthony Hopkins?
And Bob Hoskins.
Yeah, in Moorish makeup as Othello and Bob Hoskins as Iago. On a, you know, sort of look at the box and, oh, what's this going to be like? And pop it in. And I should preface that I'm slightly biased because I have such deep love for Bob Hoskins. I think he's remarkable. I think he's the short, bald, rotund Harrison Ford, I think. just everything he does is so straight and to the hilt and unapologetic. And I wish I could be an actor like that, and I'm just not. I think he's so great. But you know, like you were saying, his take on it was to just do it super sincere and kind of cuddly Smee the way he can be, and then, you know, turn into his scary Long Good Friday, you know, gangster persona when he was, you know, in his own element. But just to hear his, you know, kindly Cockney, you know, turn toward that, you know, my lord, you know I love you kind of thing was just, I don't know, remarkable. I thought it was so great, and makes total sense that if you were to do it a little too foolish or foppish, that it would.
He's not Richard III.
Mm.
He's not a clever entertainer, and that was the mistake that Richard Dreyfuss made.
Right.
And it's a very self-aggrandizing thing to do anyway. I mean, Richard should have been smarter than that.
Well, hey, there's nothing wrong with self-aggrandizing, am I right? I think it's a beautiful thing. You know, it's interesting. This is something I want to quickly mention because I did not know this, and therefore I assume most people don't. Ted Bundy. Ted Bundy was a bastard.
Yeah.
When I found that out, because I did a lot of, one of the earliest things that I did when I was working on this part was research sociopaths. And I did just, I spent hours on the computer looking up all the different sociopaths that we have records of. And when I came across Ted Bundy and I was like, oh, let me look into this guy, I went deep
the
into Ted Bundy.
The king of the modern organized sociopath archetype.
I went so deep in his history. For anybody that doesn't know, he was brought up by his grandparents under the guise that they were his parents and his mother was his sister.
Yeah.
His mother ended up moving to Texas. He followed her later. He was going to school. He had a girlfriend for about a year when she broke up with him and became the archetype for all the women that he would later kill, the shoulder-length straight hair. They believe that every woman that he killed kind of had some kind of resemblance to his girlfriend that broke his heart. Right after that happened is the exact same moment that he also found out that his sister was actually his mother, which has to just click something tremendous inside of you. And I just thought that was very interesting.
It's interesting
to think
he
about.
Has exactly the same background as John Lennon, and look how they turned
out. Yeah, right. No, here's the thing, though, is I think that part of the reason I think Ted Bundy, as horrible, obviously, as he is, the sociopathic nature of him is so brilliant. And the lines that I see that are resembling Edmund is that he went into school to be a lawyer.
Yeah.
He was
defended
incredibly,
himself,
so
and
he
by
defend-
all accounts would have gotten away with
shit.
It if not for the teeth.
Yeah.
If not for the bite marks he left on the victims. Yeah. Like, the jurors came back and said, we were with them up until then.
He's so fucking charming. And to be somebody, like, you got to know that he was sick so early on. Like, he knew. No one knew, but he knew. And so I just think his entire life was so well formulated, exactly the same way that Edmund is just got this whole plan in action. He's just waiting for his moment.
I think it was James Hillman that referred to Shakespeare as the great 16th century psychoanalyst.
Yeah, absolutely.
How prescient and brilliant of this artist, this timeless, you know, pinnacle of the English language, but also of psychological insight to acknowledge and to understand that these people existed.
Yeah.
You know, and to find ways to explore that kind of a psyche on stage.
You look at Ted Bundy, he comes from nothing. I mean, he's just this bastard without any privilege. And one of the very first things he does is, well, like, who has privilege? Well, lawyers make a pretty good living. I mean, you look at who's your archetype, like, good professions, doctors and lawyers. Well, I'm going to become a lawyer because what I want to do is kill, 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 kill. So I better know exactly what I'm going to be doing, how to get away with it. So I'm going to go into this privileged profession and do what I really want to do on the sidelines. And he had this alternate character that he played for everybody else where he was incredibly, before becoming a lawyer, he was incredibly shy, very slouchy. Just did not speak well at all. And then when he became the lawyer, he was like, I'm going to be this guy now, and I'm going to be so charming, and I am the Cary Grant of the common man.
And you just pointed out something that's very, very peculiar that I never really thought about Shakespeare, because he lived in such a violent time, you know, where everyone's armed, like Wild West.
Literally.
Yeah.
And people, all the intrigues, and the murder of Marlowe,
dagger through the eye.
Yes, and the incredible sort of internal CIA, the kind of Russian secret service that Elizabeth had, with all that going on, that he could distinguish those types, that there were people who even in this context were beyond the pale, in that they were less human. We use the word sociopath, but
But, well, you know what sociopath was originally, what that term originally, that diagnosis in the first DSM, they called it malignant narcissism.
Yes, yes. Well, hey, there's nothing wrong with narcissism.
The thing that we forget about narcissists, because we use that myth, that term has permeated the zeitgeist now. Like, people know what that is. Like, oh, narcissist, we have celebrity culture. The
important
thing,
exactly.
The important part of narcissists, of that myth, is that he drowned.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Everybody forgets that
part. Yeah, no, we're all like, no, he's so handsome. Look at this production. You think about like Lex Luger in the 80s in pro wrestling.
Right,
like, no, it's these
it
people.
It's a bad thing.
they destroy themselves.
And if you take Hillman and Jung and those folks, drowning means dispersal. So it means a disintegration of personality.
Oh, how dare you bring up Jung right at the end of the podcast. I'm going to take you out to lunch.
Next time,
we're going to talk about Jung. Well, gentlemen, this is going to be our longest episode, I think, and I'm thrilled with that. But I know that you guys have your last show tonight. I want to make sure that you guys get out of here and are able to go and rock it. So I want to say break a leg for your final performance.
Thank you.
Do you guys have anything coming out? Have the Porters decided on their next show? Leon, do you know what you're doing next? Is there anything that you'd like to talk about, share with our listeners?
Do we want
to
talk about the next show yet? It's not really. It's not down yet. It's not down on paper and pen and blood yet. Yeah. So we're not going to say anything yet. Okay. It will be. It'll probably open late spring.
Okay.
We are going to be doing something at the Fringe Festival this year. That's pretty much locked down. We haven't signed up yet.
Yeah. We might have an additional thing, but you could probably mention
The thing that we're going to do at the Fringe Festival is, it's called Limousine Midnight Blue. Jamie Hecht, who plays Kent, wrote a series of, I do believe there's 52 sonnets.
Yeah.
All based on, Kennedy's assassination. It's based off frame by frame, frame by frame of the Kennedy assassination.
Wow.
Every poem is based on a frame.
Wow.
Exactly. And he does it as a one-man show. Charlie directed him doing it a few years ago. They had a great time. And we're going to bring that to Fringe Festival this year. It's absolutely beautiful. It's beautiful. His poetry is magnificent.
He did our
Oedipus translation. He taught himself Greek in the early 90s. I told you. I was like, you don't want to talk to me. I don't want to do this, but you should talk to fucking Jamie because that guy's got it going on in his head. He can fucking talk up a storm about all sorts of crazy shit. And you're like, how do you fucking know all this? He taught himself Greek just so that he could translate Oedipus.
Like you do.
I'm drinking my Sunday morning coffee. You know what I'm going to do is I'm going to learn Greek and translate an old play. But that's something we're going to be doing at the Fringe Festival this year.
I saw the original mounting of that show, and it's very special and unique and singular, and everybody should check it out. I have a movie opening next Friday. It's already available on demand. You can find it on iTunes. It's called Would You Rather. It's a horror film starring Jeffrey Combs and Brittany Snow. Larry Cedar, our Lear, makes a little cameo appearance in it as well. And it'll be opening this coming Friday, which is February 15th, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah,
I don't know when this is going to street, but Friday the 15th, it opens at the Lemley NoHo 7.
I'll be there.
The director should be in attendance for a couple of the shows doing little Q&As.
I don't want to be there for that. Sounds terrible.
I was an associate producer on it. Would You Rather? You can find it on iTunes and come into theaters next week.
I'm also a little bit of a horror buff, so I will check it out.
Awesome.
I will be excited for that. You know what you're doing next, Lee?
I have two films that are in the festival circuit right now. That means they're looking for distribution. one's called Fuzz Track City, which is... a wonderful, zany comic film noir. And the other one is called Lost on Purpose. And it's a coming-of-age film, but it's a weird one in that it... Of course, none of you probably went through this period, but many young men, when they get out of college or when they get out of high school, they have like a drifting period where they don't know what the hell they want, but they know what they don't want. And that's... This film is about that period of time in two young men's lives. And I think it's kind of fascinating, and I play their father. For the next 6 weeks, I have nothing to do, and then I start a film that was literally written for me. And I'm in every scene, which means that 2 years from now, I'll be talking to somebody about that.
You know, everyone's talking about themselves. I'm over here talking about Jamie and Charlie, so out of character.
You get your malignant narcissism off every evening in Lear.
I do. I take my clothes off and strut around the stage as I should.
And that's not even when the show is happening.
So. That's true. That's my warm up. My warm up takes place in my underwear. That's how I get ready. It's just they were telling a story earlier.
Be true to yourself, no.
Thomas was telling a story earlier. It's funny. Joe plays the fool. I've been doing my warm up. I've been wearing jeans but no shirt. And Joe came up to me one day in front of Thomas, and he's like, "What is with you doing this warm up and you're not wearing your shirt?" And Thomas is like, "You don't know shit, man. When we were doing Hamlet, when we didn't even know this guy, he was doing his warm-up wearing nothing but underwear, and everyone is like, who the fuck is this Alex guy? We don't know this guy. He's just over there in the corner saying all these weird noises, not wearing any clothes." So the next day, I went back doing my warm-up with underwear, and I was like, "What? You all wanted this?" I heard a bunch of complaints. Like, no one was complaining. We were telling this guy, I heard complaints.
By popular demand.
I heard that people wanted me to take off more clothes. I don't know.
We went from Jung to Alex's underwear. I cannot believe this.
On a dime. That's how I roll, Leon.
All right.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure to talk to
thank
all
you.
Of you.
Thank you.
Congratulations again on the production, and break a leg with your final performance tonight.
Cool.
Thank you very much.
And we'll look forward to hearing what the porters have come down the pipe next.
Very soon.
Follow Twitter. What's your Twitter?
We should plug the Twitters. It's facebook.com/theportersofHell'sGate. It's the only thing we have with a "the" in it. And then our Twitter is it's at the Porters of HG. Our website is portersofhillsgate.com, sans the, which I remember fighting. I remember fighting that whenever we were getting the website. I was like, why aren't we doing the? Facebook and our Twitter are the.
Justin Timberlake came up and he's like, lose the
lose the. Yeah. It's cooler that way. And I was like, well, he has billions of dollars. All right, I guess we'll follow that.
But isn't he the Justin Timberlake?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Fail. Yes. A lot of the porters also have Twitters, and we're constantly tweeting nerdy Shakespeare and theatrical things. So if you do look up the Porters Twitter account, you'll see many of our resident artists as well being retweeted a lot. Yeah. So I recommend we're all. Dana has very funny things to say.
And it's a good way to know when their next show is.
It really is. Like, we keep on top of that shit pretty hard. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, check out all of the awesome stuff, dear listener, that the Porters have going on online, and stay tuned for their announcements. And we'll be around when you have your next show.
Thank you.
For myself, Jonathan Redding, my co-host,
Philip Kelly, still here.
This has been advice
to the players.
To the players. Thank you so much for listening.
We're not going to sing.
But I can.
Thomas just had too much fun with it then.